I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began a conversation with Gene Zubovich of Washington University in St. Louis. He's a professor of history, and we were talking about religious liberty, and we are continuing that conversation today. A little bit about our guest. He received his PhD from the Department of History at the University of California, Berkeley, in 2015. He writes on the history of foreign relations, human rights, religion, and politics in North America in the 19th and 20th centuries. In addition to his book, The Global Gospel, he currently has a forthcoming work appearing in The Journal of American History, Journal of the History of Ideas, Diplomatic History, Religions, and Christian Human Rights. So we welcome to Common Threads once more Professor Gene Zubovich. Hello, Gene.
Hello, Fred. Thanks for having me back.
Certainly. Briefly to recap, if someone did not tune in last week, what spurred this conversation was an article you wrote about former Governor and Senator Sam Brownback, who is now an ambassador at large for a body that Congress created not too terribly long ago. And so I wanted to just talk a little bit about that. He's ambassador at large for international religious freedom. And as you said last week, that was created in the 90s by Congress, right?
That's right.
And the people who spearheaded this effort tended to be evangelical Christians. And I'm just curious, last week, I actually wanted to ask you this last week, but we got off on so many different things. You were talking about the concerns that many evangelical Christians had about religious freedom overseas. And you mentioned places like China and the Middle East, which, of course, can be dangerous for Christians and a lot of other people, too. But you also mentioned the plight of Tibetan Buddhists. So that piqued my curiosity because I just wanted to confirm that people who were predominantly Christian were also, at least at face value, looking out for Buddhists as well, and maybe other religions. Do you know, can you talk a little bit about that, about what other religions besides Christianity might have been being taken notice of back in the 90s?
Well, I think the primary concern for most evangelical Christian communities, based on how much airtime they give certain cases, is that in the 90s as today, they're primarily concerned about their own community. So the stories you hear most about are the suffering of fellow Christians in places like China, the Middle East, and India. Now, while that is the case, right, there is also evangelical newspapers and TV programs also express a lot of concern about people in, who are being, oppressed or attacked, who live in places like, in these same places, so China, India, and the Middle East. So, one example is that Sam Brownback himself was really concerned for the plight of, a number of religious minorities in Darfur. He speaks out about issues in Nigeria, in China, and other places. So I don't want to overstate the case that people like Sam Brownback and his evangelical allies are really only concerned about their fellow Christians, but I would say it's fair to it's fair to characterize the concern as primarily about their fellow Christians, their co-believers.
Does somebody in Sam Brownback's position have to walk a careful line, or does he think he has to walk a careful line? And I realize this is speculation on your part. Between being concerned about religious liberties in Muslim countries and expressing that concern appropriately,
And also on the other side, being perceived as significantly Islamophobic.
That's right. That's a key balance. So the part of the State Department that Sam Brownback leads recently came out with a report on the state of religious liberty across the world. And what it said was that Christians are the number one persecuted community in the world. And it cites, you know, detailed evidence of that, followed, you know, closely behind Muslims, who are also persecuted in, you know, a wide number of nations across the world. So I think that, you know, in terms of the kind of research and promotion of religious liberty in a kind of academic way, I think he does a fairly good job of presenting, you know, a broad range of issues and, you know, a number of cases, right, of violations against all kinds of religious groups. And yet the kinds of challenges he takes on, the people he seems to be most concerned about and spend time thinking about, seem to be in line with what evangelical Christians more broadly are thinking about, which is the prosecution of their fellow Christians. So one example is that most recently Brownback proposed under a piece of legislation called the Global Magnitsky Act to put sanctions on Chinese leaders when they have been found to violate religious freedom in China. And so this, you know, he says will apply to, you know, not just the persecution of Christians in China, but also to the persecutions of Muslims in the south of China, to the persecution of the Falun Gafa and other religious minorities. But what's really clear to a domestic audience is this is something that evangelical Christians are very concerned about, something they are and have been pushing for a long time.
And how much of an ear of the president does he have? I've not seen any declarations or tweets about religious freedom issues. Is that just something on the back burner for now?
Well, this is the question. So, you know, it's early in Sam Brownback's tenure. But we're going to have to wait and see how this plays out over time. You know, as you know, China is negotiating right now about economic issues with the United States, about trade. And one of the big questions for Sam Brownback's supporters is, can Brownback insert, religious liberty issues into those negotiations? Now, one of the interesting things is that Brownback is the first politician to hold this post. Usually this went to, religious advocates or human rights advocates, but Sam Brownback is the first politician to be appointed to this role, and his supporters made the argument that, in fact, a politician is exactly what you need in this position because they know how to persuade other politicians to do the right thing. So we're still waiting for evidence of that. But we'll just have to wait and see if Sam Brownback, you know, given his longtime role as a senator and governor, can be a more effective advocate on behalf of religious freedom than his predecessors were.
It is interesting because it's quite clear, not just right now, but over the past few decades, that we tend to balance our concern with human rights with more mundane financial matters. And so you've given the example of China, and I'm sure that there are countries in the Middle East where we have this tension as well. Am I correct?
That's right. There are any number of countries where this tensions flare up from time to time. You know, Turkey is a big one. Certainly, many Middle Eastern nations, including Saudi Arabia, India, and other places. With multi-faith nations, these things come up all the time. And it's really tricky, right, exactly how to balance the desire to improve the state of religious freedom in countries with other things, right, most importantly, economic relations. But these concerns aren't new. They have gone back for centuries in the United States. You know, how to balance out the promotion of religious liberty with you know, other aspects of American foreign policy, like, you know, economic policy, military policy, and so on.
Gene, as much as we appreciate talking about today's situation, the history that you provide in your article is quite interesting. And I'm hoping that you can share a little bit about the aftermath of the Spanish-American War, when we were selling religious freedom, and our venture into empire.
That's right. So historians often describe the United States as an empire, you know, going back to its early history. People like Thomas Jefferson, you know, referred to the United States as an empire of liberty. And as it expanded westward in the 19th century, on the continental, you know, in the continental United States, they took over lands belonging to native peoples. They took over lands belonging to the Spanish and French and others. And so it's, the United States has long been an empire, but after the Spanish-American War, it really becomes an overseas empire for the first time. So it takes on colonies that are very distant and far away from the continental United States. And, you know, one of the most important places that this happens is in the Philippines, which the United States acquires as a colony, conquers as a colony, during the War of 1898, and it decides to make the Philippines a permanent, you know, a permanent colony. And one of the interesting things is that, you know, the Philippines are predominantly Spanish. They're populated by predominantly Catholics, where the church is, you know, an officially established church in the Philippines. And there's also a large Muslim minority in the south of the Philippines. It's called the Moro region, or the Moro peoples. And so the United States was forced to decide, you know, what should religious liberty look like in this part of the world. And essentially what they do is they try to remake, you know, this small part of the world in the image of the United States. And essentially the argument that then-President William McKinley makes is that the Filipinos can't be trusted with implementing religious liberty themselves. The United States has to go in and do it for them, right? It has to show Catholics and Muslims how to create and promote religious liberty in this place. And so what historians took away from that is that the promotion of religious liberty has been very closely tied for much of American history to the project of expanding American power and expanding American empire across the world.
But before Americans came in, there were a whole lot of Catholics and there was this Muslim minority. How well did they get along? Did they need an overseer to tell them that this is how it should be? Or were they just getting along fine and they didn't need us?
Well, what many empires do, and this included the Spanish Empire, is they essentially let local populations govern themselves. And so the Catholic parts of the Philippines could implement, you know, a kind of state Catholicism, and the southern part of the Philippines, where the population was predominantly Muslim, was, you know, could play by their own rules, essentially. So, for example, the Moro region in the south had a sultan who was both the political leader and the religious leader. And what the United States said when it came in is essentially this kind of more pluralistic version of, you know, religious diversity, you know, that says, okay, you know, Catholics over here can play by their rules, and Muslims down here can play by their own rules. The United States comes in and says, no, everybody has to play by the same rules, and it has to be essentially American rules about what religious liberty is and means.
So was the Sultan deposed, do you know?
So the Sultan, I think, was, I'm trying to remember, so either they turned him into a religious figure, or they turned him into a political figure. I can't remember exactly which one it is off the top of my head, but basically they said you can't be both. You can be one or the other. And there are many examples. Actually, a really good book on this is Anna Sue's book, Exporting I can't remember the name right now, but there are many examples in this book where the United States comes in to situations where, they take over a territory where there is, where a single leader has both political and ecclesiastic functions, and they say you can't be both, you have to be one or the other. So, for example, after World War II in Japan, the United States occupied the country, and the emperor was both the head of the country's political system and the head of the country's religious system, and they essentially turned him into a political figure and divested him of all of his religious powers. So there's a long history of the United States coming in and trying to separate religion and politics along the lines of a kind of very Protestant understanding of the separation of church and state.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Professor Gene Zubovich of Washington University in St. Louis, and we're talking about his article, America's Erratic Promotion of Religious Liberty Abroad. Coming back to these United States, you say that, thankfully, liberal Christians and Jews began championing the rights of minorities. Do you know how this movement began and what they might have accomplished? Again, this is going back to the turn of the 20th century, is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So this movement for a more religiously diverse, pluralistic America begins in the early 20th century, and it is essentially what becomes known as a kind of tri-faith or Judeo-Christian project. Of course, there are many other minority groups who, you know, are pressing for their own rights, you know, Native Americans, for example, but many of these groups don't get much of a hearing in public, whereas Jews and liberal Protestants and, you know, later on Catholics get a kind of hearing that, you know, their argument in organizations like the National Council of Christians and Jews is essentially that the United States is a multi-faith nation, or at least the Judeo-Christian nation, and one that is more pluralistic and needs to accommodate non-Protestant faiths. So while fundamentalists and evangelicals and some conservative Catholics reject this view, right, their argument is that America is essentially a Christian country, right, liberal Protestants and Jews are actually pretty successful at making this argument that the United States is a tri-faith, Judeo-Christian nation. And that's how the story begins. And by the mid-20th century, they recognize that, well, you know, maybe three faiths isn't enough to describe the United States. Maybe there are all these other, minority faiths, say Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, and there are also all these people who don't have any religion at all, agnostics, atheists, and humanists, and many others, right? And eventually they come around to the idea that these groups should be accepted as part of the American nation as well.
Yeah, the landscape is so significantly different from the beginning of the 20th century to the beginning of the 21st century. Do you see that, by and large, people are living together quite well, and that people do have the religious liberty that they believe they should have as guaranteed by the Constitution here in America?
Well, it depends. I guess no matter who you ask, I think people are pretty grim on this issue. So the religious liberty has very recently become such a divisive issue. It wasn't so long ago that domestically, right, evangelicals, fundamentalists, you know, what became later on known as the Christian right, didn't really care that much about religious liberty. In fact, they were pretty cool to it because, you know, if you apply it in the United States, that means you are you might allow, you know, Jews and Muslims and others to kind of wield, public influence and have a place in American life. So for people like, you know, the evangelist Billy Graham, you know, really religious freedom was for places like the Soviet Union and China, places abroad. Right? But as more recently, as the Christian right has started to lose a little bit of power, as courts have been, ruling in favor of things like gay marriage, they've really fallen back to a religious liberty and religious freedom argument, right? And essentially, you know, the argument, I mean, I think this is relatively well known, but essentially the argument is that, evangelical Christians and the Christian right is a kind of minority group in the United States that is essentially oppressed by a secular majority, and they need, right, on the grounds of religious liberty, to have their freedoms to do as they please preserved, especially against the requirements, of things like gay marriage, of LGBTQ rights, and so on. So, it's very recent, right, that this issue of religious liberty domestically has become such a polarizing issue because of the way it's being used in the law right now.
Yeah, we take, for example, the wedding cake case, and also some elements of the Affordable Care Act when it came to birth control and abortion. Correct? They were crying, "We need our religious liberty for those particular issues," and they've done pretty well for themselves, haven't they?
Well, I think in a more limited way. I mean, it just depends on what you take as the marker. So if you look at the goals of, evangelical Christians circa 1985 or even 1995, in many ways they've lost the culture wars, right? They've lost many of those battles. The war is obviously not over. You know, there's a lot of discussion about, Justice Kennedy retiring relatively soon, and a lot of anxiety about what is the future of abortion and other issues that conservative Christians care, and, many Americans care very much about. But it's important not to overstate the case, right, that, very recently they've been winning several court cases on relatively narrow grounds, but gay marriage, for example, seems relatively secure, and so do many other issues, public school prayer, and many other things that, conservative Christians have really cared about for a very long time that they have essentially admitted defeat on.
Right. When I was talking about victories, I was thinking specifically of, and you are correct, that was a narrow victory, but a victory nonetheless. The wedding cake case, and also the case of the ACA, specifically with, I believe it was the Little Sisters of the Poor, I think they were called. Do you know that particular case I'm talking about?
Only in the broadest terms.
Okay. They were able to squeak out a bit of a win on providing birth control to people who worked for them, who were lay people. Mm-hmm. So as we wind down briefly, Gene, can you tell us what else you're working on these days?
Oh, well, the main, I guess I'm working broadly on the history of religion and politics in the United States. I'm finishing up a book on the subject of the debates over human rights in the mid-20th century. And I have an article coming out relatively soon in Religion and Politics on the history of Christian nationalism and a lot of these things we've been touching on. So I'm definitely keeping myself busy.
That was one other thing I wanted to ask. The evangelicals who care about what's going on in other countries in terms of religious freedom. According to the article, they've sort of put other human rights issues on the back burner. And it's curious to me why they would feel the need to do that. Why can't they fight for religious freedom as well as freedom of movement and freedom of conscience and all of the other things that we certainly, most Americans certainly encourage these human rights and this social justice. But they, from what I understand, if I'm reading this correctly, they want to sort of extricate religious freedom from the rest of the freedoms. Did I read that correctly?
Yeah, I think that's right. So I should preface this by saying that evangelical Protestants, along with conservative Catholics and many others, are broadly engaged in all kinds of humanitarian losses. But at the same time, I think they see religious freedom not simply as one human right among many, but as the first freedom, the most important freedom, and look at religious freedom as a kind of standalone issue. This is the most important thing for them. And I think, right, that's really rooted in a missionary impulse, right? For them, the purpose of religious freedom is first and foremost to promote religion, right, and in particular to promote Christianity. One of the ways in which evangelical Protestants differ from liberal kind of mainline Protestants is that mainline Protestants are not as interested in proselytizing and going to, say, India and China and spreading Christianity there. Not if they're going to meet a lot of local opposition, for example, right? Whereas evangelical Christians, I think, are really concerned with the promotion of Christianity. So I think you're right to point out that, the one view of religious liberty is to look at it as a standalone issue, as something that is meant to really protect Christianity and perhaps other faiths, as they try to spread themselves across the world, right? But other people view religious freedom and religious liberty as one human right among many, right, whose purpose is to promote human justice more generally, right? So to promote human rights more generally. And these groups, right, the more liberal religious leaders, are more willing to balance religious freedom with other rights and protections. And so we see this playing out, for example, in domestic issues about LGBTQ rights and gay marriage, some of the cases you've spoken about, right? The religious left thinks, okay, well, the religious freedom needs to be balanced out with protections for sexual minorities, whereas I think evangelical Christians would say, no, the purpose of religious freedom is to protect religious communities themselves and to let them, play by their own rules, to essentially let them live out their values and ethics, in a society that's oftentimes hostile to them.
Gene, I want to thank you so much for being here last week and this week as well. It's been great.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Common Threads. My guest, Gene Zubovich, from Washington University in St. Louis. We've been talking about his article, America's Erratic Promotion of Religious Liberty Abroad. I'm Fred Stella. This is Common Threads. Join us next week on WGVU.